and welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from New York Magazine, from Religion News Service, from the Washington Post, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and unless otherwise noted, all articles are read as printed. Podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available at our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article from New York Magazine that was published on July 8th. And the title of this article is White Evangelicals Now Outnumbered by Mainline Protestants in U.S. And this is by Ed Kilgore of New York Magazine. The new 2020 Census of American Religion from the Public Religion Research Institute is out, and while it has a number of interesting findings, the most surprising is that among white Christians, mainline Protestants have reversed a long-standing decline in membership and have now surged past evangelical Protestants. The survey measured self-identification among white Christians as evangelical or born-again Protestant or other Protestant, so it is not correlated to institutional membership in this or that denomination. But generally speaking, mainline Protestants are the relatively liberal denominations that belong to the World Council of Churches, including United Methodists, Episcopalians, the Presbyterian Church USA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Christian Church, or Disciples of Christ, and other old-school WASPy brands. Meanwhile, evangelical Protestants include Southern Baptists, Churches of Christ, Conservative Methodist, Presbyterian, Lutheran, and Anglican split-off sects, and various Pentecostal and non-denominational but conservative groups. According to PRRI, mainline Protestants now account for 27% of white Christians, while evangelicals make up 23%. While white Christians as a whole have been steadily declining as a portion of the population for decades, the most recent number shows a reversal of trends between mainliners, who were experiencing an uptick in affiliation from 13% of Americans in 2016 to 16% now, and evangelicals, who continue to decline. They were 23% of the population as recently as 2006, but now stand at 14%. There was a bit of a harbinger of this development in 2013, when a Brookings PRRI study of millennials showed a significantly larger share identifying as liberal or moderate Christians, as opposed to conservative Christians. As I observed at the time, the idea that non-conservative Christianity is outmoded is itself outmoded. Still, the news that mainliners are growing as evangelicals decline will be shocking to those who have been told for many years by gloating evangelicals, as well as by secular conservatives and many non-religious observers, that liberal Protestantism is dead or dying, condemned by lax theology and too much tolerance of sinfulness. You know, women having non-marital sex, using birth control and having abortions, divorced people remarrying, and LGBTQ people coming out of the closet in defiance of God's plan. The idea that real Christianity is by definition conservative has been built into the worldviews of many opinion leaders of every persuasion. New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, a traditionalist Catholic, wrote an entire book in which the folly and uselessness of the once mighty mainliners was a major premise. Are the PRRI findings just a blip that will be forgotten when the long-standing decline of liberal Protestants and the triumphant rise of conservatives resumes? Possibly, but maybe not. Another PRRI data point was noted in a write-up by Religious News Service. White evangelicals are now the oldest religious group, with a median age of 56. White mainliners and black Protestants share the same median age, 50, with white Catholics skewing closer to evangelicals at 54. This is particularly bad news for the largest and most politically powerful conservative evangelical denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention, whose membership has declined for 13 consecutive years, and which is fighting off a strong takeover bid from those who would make the SBC more rigorously and exclusively conservative at the expense of its life-giving efforts to diversify. And it should be actively frightening to Trump-style Republicans, for whom white evangelicals are critically important. The PRRI census will also get attention for showing that the steady rise in the percentage of Americans who have no religious identification has slowed and even reversed. It's possible this trend and the intra-Christian dynamics are connected, as RNS notes. PRRI CEO Robert Jones said in an email, the survey doesn't provide precise explanations regarding the shift among white Christians. But he pointed to circumstantial evidence that suggests over the last 2 years in particular, white mainline Protestants seem to have absorbed at least some folks leaving white evangelical and other churches who may have otherwise landed in the religiously unaffiliated camp. The idea of liberal Protestants securing converts is alien to the conventional wisdom, to put it mildly. But I can attest that in my own small Disciples of Christ congregation in California, we have a rich assortment of ex-evangelicals, ex-Catholics, and even ex-LDS members. Politically minded conservative evangelicals and their conservative Catholic allies often cite the importance of religious liberty when discussing their efforts to legally discriminate against feminists and LGBTQ folks in the name of Jesus Christ. But there is also religious liberty to move from one group of believers to another, and for the first time in living memory, the conservatives are no longer confidently triumphant in that spiritual competition. Our next article on religion in the news this week comes from Religion News Service, and the headline on this article, AME General Conference Debate on Same-Sex Marriage Continues After Bill Is Voted Down. Subheadline, the measure would have repealed a section in the AME Book of Discipline that prevents clergy from performing such marriages. This article is by Catherine Post of Religion News Service. A bill concerning same-sex marriage failed to pass on its second reading Wednesday, July 7th, at the African Methodist Episcopal Church General Conference, the denomination's quadrennial meeting taking place in Orlando, Florida this week. The proposed bill was submitted by Ravi K. Perry, chair of the Political Science Department at Howard University, who specializes in black politics and minority representation, among other topics. It was designed to repeal a section in the AME Book of Discipline that prevents clergy from performing same-sex marriages. By simply deleting the section, Perry wrote in his proposal, the church would be then permitting local churches and pastors to welcome LGBTQ parishioners into full membership in God's house. The Holy Scriptures do not explicitly forbid same-sex attraction, companionship, love, and marriage, particularly not as it is practiced in monogamous partnerships and is largely understood as today in the 21st century. But the assembled delegates agreed with a motion that the bill could not be debated on the floor because it violated a 2004 decision that stated same-sex marriage was not the will of God. After the vote, motions to revive the bill on procedural and ethical issues were made, and according to the Reverend Renita Marie Green, lead correspondent for the AME's official publication, The Christian Recorder, the debate is not over until the General Conference is over. There are people who care about the divine in all humans who are working hard to make sure that the whole person is fully included in the life of our church, without penalty to pastors who choose to love others as God has loved us, said Green. While the AME Church prohibits clergy from performing same-sex marriages, it does not bar LGBTQ individuals from serving as pastors or otherwise leading the denomination. The ban penalizes clergy for fully pastoring members of our church, said Green. So there are many people who, while they may not agree theologically with same-gender marriages, disagree with the penalty that pastors would suffer for fully pastoring members of their congregation and community. The issue of same-sex marriage is complicated for any denomination to consider, but perhaps especially for the AME Church, whose members in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world often hold more traditional theological views. Any individual in the AME Church can propose legislation. After it is submitted, the proposed bill is reviewed by a revisions committee that considers whether the measure is legal and necessary and what its implications may be. The committee then decides whether to recommend the bill to be presented to the General Conference. Currently, there are 55 bills in the queue for consideration at the 2021 General Conference. The bills are then voted on by the delegates and are decided upon based on Robert's Rules of Order. They need 50% plus one for a bill to pass. According to Green, once a bill is passed, it becomes effective immediately. Before the second reading, Perry, who is gay, said that passing the bill would be a momentous occasion for the oldest black denomination in the world. We are a church that was founded because we were marginalized, he said. If this were to pass, the vote would symbolize our commitment from the beginning to be a beacon of light for the marginalized. And this particular generation, that's for LGBTQ people like me. We'll turn next to the New York Times in this article published on July 6th. And the title of this article is Sermongate Prompts a Quandary. Should Pastors Borrow Words from One Another? Subheadline, the new leader of the Southern Baptist Convention has delivered sermons containing passages from those of his predecessor, causing a furor. This article is by Ruth Graham of the New York Times. The similarities in the sermons are unmistakable. I don't think I've given you this before, the pastor in North Carolina tells his congregation. He goes on to list five selves that signify hostility to God: self-will, self-glory, self-gratification, self-righteousness, and self-sufficiently. Cut to an older pastor in Alabama at a lectern a year later. "Let me give you five selves," he says. He rattles off the same list. A video comparing the two sermons has racked up thousands of views online in recent days, partly because the two men are not just any church leaders. The first, who delivered his sermon in 2019, is J.D. Greer, the departing president of the Southern Baptist Convention. The other is Ed Litton, who was elected as Mr. Greer's successor just a couple of weeks ago by a thin margin at an unusually contentious meeting. His sermon was delivered in 2020 and did not credit Mr. Greer. Mr. Litton's critics are calling it Sermongate, and the dust-up has revealed a dirty little secret of the preaching life. Many pastors borrow from one another in the pulpit, and the norms around the practice are fuzzy at best. Over the past week, anonymous YouTube accounts have posted multiple side-by-side comparisons of the two men preaching, highlighting nearly identical metaphors, anecdotes, and turns of phrase. Mr. Litton's church removed sermons from 2017 through 2019 from its website and YouTube, attributing the deletions to both a website redesign and a response to people going through sermons in an attempt to discredit and malign our pastor. Mr. Litton declined an interview request through a spokesman. In a statement, Mr. Litton said he had asked Mr. Greer for permission to borrow from at least one sermon and apologized for not crediting him. Mr. Greer confirmed his account. But accusations of lying and stealing, and plenty of memes skewering Mr. Litton, are flying fast. Some of the same Baptists who opposed Mr. Litton's election are now calling for his resignation. "This is an issue of morality, and it's an issue of Christian virtue," said Tom Askell, a high-profile Florida pastor who has been critical of Mr. Litton and Mr. Greer. "It's something that as recently as 10 years ago, everyone in conservative evangelical circles would say, of course, pulpit plagiarism is wrong." Karen Swallow Pryor, a professor at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, who has written about plagiarism, called the episode surprising. "What this whole thing has opened up is there are people who have an unstated expectation that a pastor is delivering his own examination and wrestling with the biblical text, and others who may not have that expectation at all." Among church leaders, attitudes toward the practice vary widely. Al Mohler, Jr., president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, has called it despicable. The influential retired pastor John Piper has said it is unthinkable. But some prominent pastors have offered others carte blanche to borrow liberally from their work, saying personal glory should never be the point of preaching. Others encourage heavy inspiration, but not wholesale copying. As the oft-cited, though not always attributed, line goes from the longtime Southern Baptist pastor Adrian Rogers, "If my bullet fits your gun, shoot it, but use your own powder." Condoned or not, the practice, once revealed, can leave a bad taste. Within Protestantism especially, pastors' weekly sermons are the most high-profile and highly scrutinized work product. Worship services often culminate in the delivery of a presumably original sermon, which can often last 45 minutes or more. "When congregations call or hire a pastor, they're calling that person to preach," said Tom Rayner, chief executive of the consulting firm Church Answers, which advises church leaders on issues including growth and communications. "Preaching is central." But a great sermon is also laborious to produce. It can include deep analysis of biblical texts, historical research, compelling anecdotes, a dose of humor, and a stirring call to action. Now imagine producing at least one such message every week, year after year, all based on the same collection of texts and delivered to the same audience. Some full-time pastors report spending up to 30 hours a week on the task. More common is devoting 2 full workdays to it. For many churchgoers, a sermon is not just a clever speech, but proof of the pastor's deep spiritual life. A sermon is a person studying the Bible, encountering God in their own life and history, and then spewing it all out on Sunday morning for the good of the people of God, said Scott McKnight, a professor of the New Testament at Northern Seminary in Lisle, Illinois. It's a personal encounter. With access to the most charismatic pastors and snappiest sermons via YouTube and podcasts, churchgoers' standards are rising, Mr. McKnight said. Many megachurch pastors become household names far from their own communities purely because of their preaching. "They've built these big churches because of their charisma," he said. "It has really hurt the small church pastor." Revelations of egregious pulpit plagiarism can rattle churchgoers who believe they are receiving their pastor's original wisdom. Near Nashville, Andy Traub was stunned when his church announced that its pastor had been plagiarizing whole sermons, including personal anecdotes that he had presented as his own. How do you find out about your pastor? Mr. Traub asked. For the vast majority of people, it's from his sermons. If 95% of the stories he told us were not true, then who is he? Mr. Traub's pastor left the church in 2016 and now leads a congregation in Michigan. Spot checking has become radically easier just in the past year. Forced by the pandemic to gather online, many churches scrambled to ramp up their technological capabilities. Now Mr. Rainer estimates that more than 70% of Sunday sermons are posted on the Internet. Sermongate has also prompted a sprawling debate about the widespread practices of ghostwriting and research assistance that takes place out of the view of many ordinary churchgoers. Full texts and outlines of sermons are widely available on websites like Sermon Central and Logos, ostensibly for reference and inspiration. Consulting services like Docent Research Group offer pastors substantial help with research and planning. Some larger churches, including Mr. Litton's, employ in-house preaching teams that collaborate on sermon production. In a now-deleted endorsement on Docent's website, Mr. Greer thanked the organization for saving him time on sermon prep. I often have people remark to me, "How many hours did you spend on that sermon? Where do you get time to do all that research?" he wrote. "Ha! Thanks, guys, for making me look so good." In an email, Mr. Greer said he had sometimes relied on research assistants and other aides to help him prepare sermons, a practice he had discussed openly in the past. The dilemma of sermon research is that we are trying to express God's word, which never changes, in our unique context and with our unique voices, he said. That requires deep awareness of the work of others and a commitment to expressing those timeless truths originally. For some who have quietly contributed to sermons over the years, the episode also raises painful questions about who is allowed to speak with authority and who is not. Gina McCown, a writer in Florida, recalled an incident several years ago when her pastor at the time asked her to send him an outline with bullet points for a sermon he was planning on a thorny topic she knew well. The church did not ordain women as pastors or allow them to preach on Sunday mornings. Ms. McCown was indignant but did not want to stir up trouble. She did the bare minimum, sending the pastor some brief notes and resources. It's a huge double standard, she said, of asking women to contribute uncredited insights within churches that bar them from preaching. If you truly believe she can't get up on that stage and deliver the sermon herself, then she can't write it. Stand on that conviction. Mr. Litton has said he relies on a team of 8 men to help craft his sermons. In a podcast interview released on Friday, he said the process lets him mentor aspiring leaders and keep my voice young. He vowed to do a better job crediting his sources in the future. What is certain is that the temptation to crib on Sunday mornings is not new. In his autobiography, Benjamin Franklin wrote of his admiration of a young Presbyterian preacher much respected for his preaching, which was apparently delivered extemporaneously. When a doctrinal dispute erupted in the congregation, however, an adversary recognized that a passage delivered by the preacher had been lifted from an uncredited source. Franklin stuck by the plagiarist. "I rather approved his giving us good sermons composed by others," he wrote, "than bad ones of his own manufacture." Our next article this week is on religion in the news, comes from the Washington Post, dated July 8th. And the title of this article is "New Study Shows Dramatic Gap in Religious Diversity Between the Southeast and Much of the Country." And this article is by Michelle Boorstein of the Washington Post. A new sweeping religion survey of nearly 500,000 Americans shows some regions of the country remain religiously homogenous, especially the Southeast, and charts the growing political influence of the religiously unaffiliated, whose presence has more than doubled in both major parties in recent years. Public Religion Research Institute analyzed data on interviews with more than 500,000 Americans from 2013 to 2019 and combined it with data from the U.S. Census Bureau on 3,142 counties across the country. The project offers a picture of the religious demographics of every county, including Maryland's Montgomery and Howard counties, which rank in the top 10 most diverse. The survey and analysis digs deep into the big picture story of American religion, dramatic change in the past 20 years, especially the shrinking of the white Christian population and the growth of religiously unaffiliated Americans. PRRI says those two trends appear to be slowing in the last couple years, but CEO Robert Jones says it is too early to know if it's more like a pause. White Christians have gone as a proportion of the U.S. population from 65% in 1996 to 42% in 2018. PRRI found that the number ticked up in 2019 and 2020 to 44%. Other major pollsters found slightly different numbers, with Pew Research saying it was 40% in 2020. Past trends are not guaranteed to continue, Jones said. These are expressions of broad social changes in the country, and we don't know what kind of upheavals will shift things. The news here is that these trends we've been watching, which looked the same for a decade, now look slightly different. Looking at young Americans, some trend lines appear to be moving in one direction. Last year, 36% of Americans age 18 to 29 told PRRI they have no religious affiliation, compared with 23% of that same age group in 2006 and 10% in 1986. 23% of all Americans say they are unaffiliated, PRRI found. However, for 20 years, as the unaffiliated population began to increase, estimates of its size by different polling outfits have varied by as much as 10 percentage points. Gallup found those who were unaffiliated were about 20% of the adult population in 2020, while Pew Research estimates the figure is 28%. The PRRI survey found the unaffiliated are becoming a much larger part of both parties, the Democrats in particular. Between 2006 and 2020, the percent of Republicans who say they are unaffiliated went from 4 to 13%. The percent of Democrats went from 9 to 23%. A book out this year by three well-known political scientists called The Secular Surge seeks to advance the years-long discussion about the non-religious and their growing political influence. The book, by John Green, Jeffrey Lehman, and David Campbell, identifies the boom in Americans who are decidedly secular in their outlook, not just unaffiliated. These are people who are guided by their understanding of the observable natural world and committed to science and objective evidence. 1 in 4 Americans are secularists, the author's research finds, and the movement is growing among the young. Chapters of the Secular Student Alliance went from 42 in 2003 to hundreds today, the book says, reflecting organizing and political mobilizing. The book argues that the core divides in the Democratic Party, between progressives and centrists, highly evident in the 2020 presidential race, has secularism at the very heart of such battles for the soul of the Democratic Party. In other words, unaffiliated and secular Americans are growing in both parties, but especially so on the Democratic side, creating an important fault line, the authors argue, with core Black and Latino constituencies. Secular voters generally are more progressive, including on issues like defense spending, the desire for free college education, and exemptions from anti-discrimination laws for religious people and businesses. The PRRI study offers a unique look at the religious composition of each county by different metrics, including overall diversity and how much of each country is made up of groups such as Latino Catholics, Latter-day Saints members, and others. It uses darker and lighter blues to signify the presence of a pattern. The map showed increased overall diversity in the West, Midwest, Northeast, and in various spots across the country, especially in and around cities. The Southeast quadrant is especially light on diversity. What's remarkable is you can see the cultural history of the country in these maps, said Jones, noting religious settlement patterns that endure. You can still see the history of the Civil War, with white evangelicals still concentrated in the Southeast, white non-evangelicals in the upper Midwest and Northeast. You can still see that North-South divide. Hispanic Catholics are concentrated in the South, Southwest, and South Florida, while Muslims are scattered in small clusters around the country. We'll wrap up this week on religion and news with an article published in Foreign Policy. This was published on July 1st, and the title of this article is "The Chinese Communist Party is Scared of Christianity." Subheadline, "Religion Remains One of the Greatest Sources of Resistance to Authoritarian Rule." This article is by Azim Ibrahim, a columnist at Foreign Policy and a director at the New Lines Institute for Strategy and Policy, and we will have to edit this slightly for time. In 2018, the Vatican signed a deal with the Chinese Communist Party, attempting to regularize the status of the underground church. The details of the arrangement were kept secret from the laity. 3 years later, however, the repression of Christians, whatever their denomination, is at its highest point since the Cultural Revolution. As the Chinese Communist Party celebrates its centenary, Christianity and other faiths remain among the challengers it fears most. Religious controls have been part of communist practice since the foundation of the People's Republic of China. As a result, churches split into patriotic associations, officially sanctioned if frowned upon. Unrecognized denomination status ranged, depending on the governance mood, from fully underground to operating openly but cautiously. Recent restrictions on Christian practices began to intensify in 2018, the same year the accord with the Vatican was signed. Since then, many churches have been shut down, mostly unsanctioned ones, but including some officially recognized groups. Between 5,000 and 10,000 Christian churchgoers have been arrested. Some prominent Protestant clergy have been given long prison sentences, and around two-thirds of China's Protestants have resorted to underground churches in an attempt to avoid police harassment. Government officials have been asked to compile more details of worshippers, feeding into discrimination in employment, especially in official posts. All children under age 18 have been strictly prohibited from attending any kind of religious education, theoretically already the case, but not strongly enforced beforehand. Religious leaders are now expected to spend more time extolling the CCP and Chinese President Xi Jinping personally than they do seeing to their flock. In some churches, icons of Jesus or Mary have already been replaced with portraits of Xi. The assault on Christian practice in China is, of course, neither new nor unique. The CCP has always imposed limits on believers, and Chinese imperial states' relationships with faith were often fraught. During the Tang Dynasty in the 9th century, Emperor Wuzong sought to cleanse the country of foreign influences. He targeted not just Buddhism, then seen as an outside Indian religion, but also Nestorian Christianity and Manichaeism. China's current fixation with foreign religion has its roots in the 19th century Qing Dynasty, when Christianity and its attendant missionaries were intimately linked with Western imperial powers, picking apart the Chinese Empire, during what Chinese historians call the Century of Humiliation. The Taiping Rebellion, led by an eccentric Chinese Christian leader who preached his own localized version of the faith and accompanied by Islamist rebellions across the country, only solidified the fear of foreign religions in the mind of the Chinese elite. In recent years, Islam has been even more of a target than Christianity, not least because it's closely associated with specific ethnic groups, such as the Uyghurs, the target of an ongoing genocide in the western region of Xinjiang. At least 1 million people have been locked up in re-education camps designed to erase their ethnic and religious identity through indoctrination and torture. The ultimate goal seems to be to suppress any kind of identity, religious, ethnic, or ideological, that might challenge the CCP's authority, whether now or in the future. Christianity may be the most common. Statistics are tricky business in China, but there may be as many as 100 million believers, more than the 90 million members of the Chinese Communist Party. Some perhaps overly optimistic estimates see as many as 250 million Christians in China by 2030. All that makes the faith, however disparate and disunified Christian belief is, inherently threatening to the CCP. The party has compromised on almost all the socialist values it nominally espouses since former Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping's reforms in the 1980s, leaving many in the country with an intense sense of a moral vacuum. In other words, even if what you care about most is socialist values, Christianity enables you to practice and advocate those values without putting you in a position to defend the indefensible actions of the party hierarchy over the past century. No wonder the party fears Christianity, but the CCP may be making it a rod for its own back. As space for all forms of belief other than belief in Xi are squeezed out of China, the flames of martyrdom may be surprisingly inspiring. We've run out of time for this week on Religion in the News. We thank you so much for tuning in and hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget you can get podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We'll talk to you next time. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.